And we turn now to the role of judges and juries in criminal cases. Earlier this week, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco overturned the death sentences of more than 100 prisoners in three states because their sentences were imposed by a judge instead of a jury. In writing the majority opinion, Judge Sidney Thomas wrote, quote, "Fact-finding by a jury rather than by a judge is more likely to heighten the accuracy of capital sentencing proceedings." He went on to say that a judge may be less likely to reflect the current conscience of the community and more likely to consider capital punishment as just another sentence. This hour, we focus on the role of judges and juries in major trials. If it was you, would you rather face a jury or a judge? We'd especially like to hear the answers to that question from those of you who've served on juries. Whose verdict is fairer and more legitimate? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email at totn@npr.org. Joining us now from his office here in Washington is Charles Lane, who covers legal affairs for The Washington Post, and it's good of you to be with us today.
Thanks, Neil. I'm glad to be here.
The decision by the Ninth Circuit to overturn the death sentences, this was based on their interpretation of a Supreme Court ruling from last year, Ring versus Arizona. Tell us about that.
Well, that was a case in which the Supreme Court basically said that in those handful of states where the judge or a panel of judges decides whether or not you get the death penalty, the people who are sentenced that way are being denied their constitutional right to a jury trial. And as a result, all future cases would have to be done by juries. They left unanswered, however, the somewhat more technical question of whether this ruling would be applied retroactively. So what the Ninth Circuit was doing was saying, yes, it should be applied retroactively to all these people in our jurisdiction, which is the Western United States. And the biggest number of people on death row in that area are in Arizona, where there are approximately 90 people who would be affected by this ruling. And there's the ones that put it over 100 come from Idaho and Montana.
Now, different appellate courts had ruled on that question of retroactivity differently. So this is likely to go back to the Supreme Court, right?
Yes, I think that's a done deal almost. Obviously, they still have to make that decision formally. Even if there hadn't been a conflict among the courts, the sheer number of people involved, I think, would have made the justices view this as a case that was so important they would have to take a look at it.
Now, the number of these states that have these so-called hybrid verdicts, where a jury will often decide guilt or innocence and then a judge may decide on the penalty phase of the trial, that's a fairly limited number of states at this point. But what was the Supreme Court's thinking? Why did they decide that juries are more important or more decisive or fairer than judges?
Well, one crucial part of it is the standard of proof that a jury uses. The jury uses beyond a reasonable doubt, whereas the judge finds facts by what they call a preponderance of the evidence, in layman's terms, more likely than not, 51 to 49 or something like that. So you can see right away that it is to the defendant's advantage to have the jury finding the facts. As you know, a death penalty can only be imposed when a fact finder has determined that the aggravating factors, the things that make the crime particularly horrible, outweigh the mitigating ones, the things that might tend to make you view the defendant more sympathetically, such as the fact that he had a terrible upbringing or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so that is an absolutely crucial determination. And I believe the court's bottom line view was that the Constitution required the defendant to have the benefit of the jury's consideration.
There is also a question about the fairness of a judge. This is a person who may be up for election or a person who may owe his appointment to some particularly powerful politician and somebody who also might be swayed by the feelings of the community.
Particularly in capital punishment cases because, as has happened in many states around the country, if you're running for re-election as a judge, one of the things that's most often challenged in the campaign is your record on crime, and sometimes people are attacked as weak on crime if they don't impose a lot of death sentences. It so happens that in this particular case, the Summerlin case that was just decided, the judge was a terrible judge. He later had to leave the bench and was disbarred because he was using marijuana heavily and buying marijuana, and there's some evidence he was actually high during these proceedings. Now, that's an extreme illustration, but what it does raise is another point in favor of the jury, namely that you have more people paying attention to the information, and your fate doesn't hinge on just one.
Maybe that pint of Haagen-Dazs on the bench might have given it away. but it's also a question of juries, and I don't know about you, Charles, but you know, I've been on juries, and you know, I'm not sure I would want to leave my fate up to the hands of you know, these people who inevitably bring their baggage with them.
I'm sure that the states who had these judge-based systems for sentencing thought that it would be fairer, that you would be putting the decision in the hands of an expert, in the hands of somebody who is not a member of the community, doesn't feel so linked necessarily to the passions and interests of the ordinary person, but is a little bit loftier, more above the fray. So in a way, these cases all demonstrate that you really could make a plausible case either way for judge or jury. And ultimately what the Supreme Court was trying to determine is whether there's any constitutional rule that should make the call, and as we've seen, they have.
Let's take a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255, and Stacy joins us on the line from Wilson, Wyoming.
Hello.
Hi.
My comment is that several years ago when I lived back east, I worked in legal video where I would go and take videotape depositions in civil cases mostly and then play them back in court. And in my experience, you know, I would watch jurors often during these playbacks nod off, sort of seem a little disinterested, and the judges, you know, they were always very attentive, and, you know, they always had a vested interest. And I appreciate, you know, we're blessed to have a country where we have a trial by our peers, but when juries are paid, you know, $7 a day in the experience that I had to come to court, and sometimes it could be a week or 2 weeks of a trial, you know, how much are these people invested?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's where do you weigh judges' experience and their knowledge and their years of trying cases with, you know, maybe a jury's feeling on things?
These were all kinds of different cases, though. What about the big-time cases, you know, murder, armed robbery, that sort of thing? Did it make any difference?
Well, I mean, I think a bit, but it was almost a joke. You'd have, if you played a videotape deposition back, for instance, after lunch, you'd dim lights in a courtroom, and we had one very kind of a neat judge who, you know, before cross-examination or something, he would say, okay, turn on the lights, okay, everybody stand up, and, you know, it was sort of a ha-ha, okay, you know, the judge is making everyone get up, but I thought that was really good on his part because you were constantly checking in with the jurors, but some of these playbacks could be 2 hours,
yeah,
with the lights dimmed, and how much are jurors who are, you know, a cross section of the population, you know, they're taking off work and or. You know.
I'm afraid we're losing your phone there, Stacy, but thanks very much for your comment. I think we got the gist of it, and we would also like to thank Charles Lane for his time. Good of you to come in today, Charles. I know you're busy.
You're very welcome, Neil.
Charles Lane covers legal affairs for the Washington Post, and he was on the ISDN line from the Washington Post office here in Washington, D.C. We'll have more after a break as we focus on judges and juries. Which is fairer? 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Cohn, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later on this hour, we'll talk with Ralph Eubanks about understanding Jim Crow Mississippi, so you want to stay tuned for that. Now, though, we're talking about the role of judges and juries in major criminal cases. Our guest is Paul Lisnek, a trial lawyer and a jury consultant. His book, The Hidden Jury, is due out next week, and he joins us now from where are you? Where are you, Paul?
I am talking to you from Chicago, Neil.
Our bureau in Chicago. Good to have you on the program.
Good to be with you.
Now, the ruling that the Ninth Circuit handed down earlier this week puts decision-making in major criminal cases, and they're talking about death penalty cases, back squarely in the hands of the jury. Isn't that what the Constitution already guarantees, a trial by jury of one peer, Sixth Amendment?
Well, you know, you have to be careful about what the Constitution guarantees. There are a lot of guarantees that aren't necessarily in the Constitution that over the years case law and interpretation have given us. What we're entitled to, of course, is a right to a speedy trial. And with regard to the concept of a jury of our peers, that is not, that's not in the Constitution. That is something that has been an interpretation throughout the years. The real question is, what are a jury of our peers, or what constitutes a peer? And that's, I think, where all the issues are.
Okay. Now, there are a lot of, we mentioned earlier, so-called hybrid systems, where juries either advise judges during the penalty phase, but the judge makes the final decision. And that system, I guess, still exists in Florida, Alabama, Delaware, and Indiana, right?
That is correct.
Now, in your book, you say the concept of a fair and impartial jury is a myth. Why is that?
Well, people have this sort of view that when jurors walk in, or the judge for that matter, that we can sort of put aside our life experiences, all the baggage that we carry in with us, and we don't. The reality of it is, while we don't want to leave common sense out the door, we also don't want to forget the life experiences that we've had. The truth is, we can't. And so when judges and juries are questioning witnesses in the voir dire process or the jury selection process, the reality of it is the lawyers have a mission. They are looking for jurors who actually are not fair and impartial. They want jurors who are sort of sided in a way favorable for their client.
And they work very hard to get that jury if they can.
Well, they do that. In fact, you know, the sort of behind the scenes work, which thanks for mentioning the book, The Hidden Jury, because that's really what the book is all about. All the research that goes on before you ever walk into that courtroom to understand what makes people tick. How will certain jurors or potential jurors react and respond to a particular case, to a case theme, to a set of facts in the case? People will react differently, and defense lawyers and prosecutors often don't want the same person there.
Now, these so-called jury consultants are only available to the relatively wealthier among us, but it's something that even pro bono lawyers will do on their own.
Well, that's a myth. The O.J. trial sort of put the jury consultant on the map. No one really knew much of a jury consultant publicly before then. But consultants have been around as far back as the 60s, perhaps before then. And I have to say that where the field got its start is not in these big, wealthy cases, but it is in the cases of the underprivileged defendant. It is in the criminal cases for people who are underrepresented, who can't afford sometimes a very sufficient defense. Most jury consultants these days will give of their time pro bono in critical cases, in criminal cases where the work is needed. We just don't read about that. We read about the cases where we make lots of money in civil work.
Well, let's get back to the issue of judges and juries. And joining us now on the line is Jack in Herndon, Virginia.
Hello.
Hi.
I would have to say that I would, if I were innocent, I would rather have a judge being handing down the decision. But if I were guilty, I would want the jury. And it has exactly to do with what he just said about the consultants looking for the right jury that will respond to whatever it is that they're trying to make them focus on rather than the facts at hand.
Paul Lisnick, do people get are juries more likely to, either fined for the, life without parole as opposed to the death penalty, or be kinder to you on innocent and guilty than a judge?
Well, Neil, before I answer that, if I can also respond to the premise of Jack's question, which is that jury consultants are out there studying people but not judges. Au contraire, in a case where a judge is going to make a decision, you better believe consultants are taking a look at the judge as well and their history and what they tend to do. So that is not an unstudied area. Directly to your question, juries... And I'm going to say this blanketly, and I'm always uncomfortable making sort of general statements, but juries will tend to be more lenient, if only because you've got to convince only one of 12 people to opt for life as opposed to death. And so defense lawyers especially want to be in front of a group of jurors because they're not playing to the whole group. I mean, they may, but all they want is one person who will see that this defendant, who during the penalty phase now is admittedly guilty of the crime accused, there is a reason to keep this person around on earth.
Okay, Jack, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's bring into the conversation someone who has heard thousands of criminal cases in a long career on the bench. Earl Strayhorn was a judge for 28 years, serving 24 of those in the criminal division of the Circuit Court in Cook County, Chicago. And Judge Strayhorn, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Mr. Conan.
What was your reaction when you read the Ninth Circuit ruling this week saying juries rather than judges should decide on capital punishment?
Well, I wasn't surprised since that happens to be the procedure that Arizona has followed for so many years. We don't follow that exact procedure here in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't surprise me as to the decision because of Arizona's criminal procedure with reference to capital cases.
Now, it does work differently in Illinois, and as I understand it, you made the decision in capital cases several times.
I made it six times in a 28-year experience as a judge. I sentenced six defendants to death.
And were those sentences carried out?
No, all of the people that I sentenced to death are still on death row and in various phases of the appellate process, either on the state side. No, I think all of their state appellate cases have been decided, and they're now on the federal side with reference to their appeals.
Given your experience, the judge in the Ninth Circuit case, Sidney Thomas, wrote, "Fact-finding by a jury rather than by a judge is more likely to heighten the accuracy of capital sentencing proceedings." Do you agree with what he said?
I have just read Judge Thomas's decision, and I don't usually comment on judges' opinions until I've had a chance to read it all, and since I've just read it, I think I feel qualified to comment. I do not agree with that wholeheartedly.
What's your difference with him?
I think judges can be as, and generally are, as fair as jurors are. We have a wonderful system in our country, the jury system being one of the principal parts of the system that separates our system from other systems around the world. And it's wonderful to be able to say that our judges and our juries can, in the face of much uproar in many of these cases, end up with a fair decision in spite of all.
The judge also wrote that a judge may be less likely to reflect the current conscience of the community. And I wondered if you had a reaction to that. Do you feel as a judge that you're supposed to be the conscience of the community?
No, I don't. I don't think that as a judge that I'm the community's avenging angel. So to that extent, I don't think that my decision reflects what the conscience of the community is or what the conscience of the community feels ought to be the decision. So to that extent, no, I don't.
I wonder, it's certainly an awesome decision to have to make, and if it's done by a jury, at least if a death sentence is coming out of it, you're sharing the burden of that with 11 other people. If it's a judge, it's all yourself.
That's true.
Is that a problem?
Certainly it's a problem. It's a problem to the extent that it should make the judge, as it should make the jury, much more careful in the consideration of the evidence that is presented to the judge in that capital sentencing case.
We have an email that came to us from Jeff Orchard. He writes, "Jurors are screened for biases and prejudices, both generally and with respect to the particulars of the specific case, before they're selected. Judges who may be honestly trying to be fair and impartial are irredeemably tainted by virtue of their day-to-day participation in the criminal justice system." He bases his opinion on 10 years of being a public defender in Washington, D.C. Obviously not the same venue, but I was wondering if you get a response to that.
Well, that's his opinion as a public defender, but I don't think that I was tainted by my 24 years sitting in the criminal division of our system from being fair and impartial in all of my cases. Well, and I didn't allow events and circumstances in other cases to impact or influence me in a decision that I made with reference to the case that was before me, if it had no bearing as to the legal facts that were to be determined by me in that particular case.
Well, Earl Strayhorn, I'm sorry, I didn't want to cut you off. You wanted to finish your thought?
No, I finished.
Well, Judge Strayhorn, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Earl Strayhorn is a retired judge who served on the circuit court in Cook County, Chicago, which is where we reached him today. And Paul Lisnick, I wonder what you made of his argument.
I have great admiration and respect for Judge Strayhorn. He's certainly a well-known figure here. But as I listen with my jury consultant ears, I heard, you know, what I expect to hear. Who is going to say my decision is fair and biased or unfair and biased? Who's going to say I absolutely respond to the events of the community? We already heard about the judge who's smoking pot while he's on the bench. So the bottom line is judges do mean to be fair. They intend to be fair, I think, as a rule. But the bottom line is that when you have a defendant and your comment from the public defender, of course, he wants to speak to a jury mm-hmm. because the reality of it is the people who come in from the community, you know, judges will sentence people all day long, take this for what I mean by it, but you know they make this decision all the time. For jurors, it's a once in a lifetime decision. Now you want to tell me who that decision weighs more heavily on? If I'm a defense lawyer, give me the jury.
Here's an email we got from John Derenberger in San Diego. Hello, I've served on a jury for a criminal trial. I can tell you that we as jurors took our job very seriously, regardless of the severity of the crime or lack thereof. We were all there to do a job and fulfill our obligations as U.S. citizens. There seems to be a stigma that ordinary people don't care, are uninformed, or simply don't care, as he says. From all my experiences in France, I can tell you this couldn't be further from the truth. This going back, I guess, to our earlier caller who said, you know, that she kept watching jurors nod off.
You know, that's right. As you read that, I was thinking about that was Stacy, I think, from mm-hmm. Wyoming. And but judges not off. Trials are boring, Neil. Even the most interesting, you know, when the Court TV network first came on the air, and I do a lot of work for them. But at the same time, I thought to myself, who could sit and watch an entire trial? The same people who watch golf, I imagine. But but the bottom line is that they're edited. Those trials are edited because real trials are lengthy and boring, and it's real tough to stay awake throughout. But you know what? That's the lawyer's job. The lawyers, the judge, have to keep people with it and be sure that the jurors are taking in all the information. And by the way, if you are having people get tired, we are all human, I would rather have 12 people in a jury room who, in batting about the facts, end up having a disagreement over what a witness said and saying, you know what, that's not what was said. I want to see the transcript. Who's the judge going to question when he or she is sitting back saying, hey, that's the way I remember it?
Let's get another caller. David's on the line from Philadelphia.
Yeah, hi. My experience as a witness in district court or in federal court and as a juror in local court has actually been very positive. My experience in the local court was to be called, to be sent forward to a criminal court and to be excused because I was a federal officer. They didn't, you know, the defense attorney didn't want me on the jury, and then to be selected for a civil trial that, you know, frankly, it was about a misrepresentation and selling of a horse. And if ever there was something that should have been incredibly boring, I think that probably qualifies. Yet we all, I thought, dealt with it very, very, with a great deal of gravity, that if it got this far, we were going to do our job, and that 3 days was worth our time. My experience as a witness has been the same. That, you know, here we have juries who, again and again and again, are paying attention to every word that you're saying. And, yes, you do have the individuals who are not. Plus, I get to sit in the court and watch their faces during the period, and there's a lot of gravity given to the situation. I think that when you're dealing with the judges...
David, I have to interrupt just to say yes, that you're please. Listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I apologize. Would you finish your thought, please?
Sure. My final thought would be about the judges. My experience with judges as a whole is that the judges are as interested in keeping control or reins over the trial as anything else. When you look at the O.J. Simpson trial, which I think had a profound impact on the way people viewed the system... The real problem was that Judge Ito lost total control of the trial. It
yeah.
became a complete farce in and of itself. And I think a lot of people's opinions are being are being affected by that experience.
Okay, David, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
All right, bye.
Couple of proposals that we've received, and this Paul Lisnick, we just have a couple of minutes left. This is an email from Doug Descombaz in Minneapolis. I believe there should be a constitutional amendment that requires a check and balance in such death decisions. The jury should have the first say in making the death decision. If the jury decides the guilty party should be executed, then the judge should have a veto opportunity. The judge should not ever have the ability to overturn a non-death decision. Is that something that might fly? I mean, constitutional amendments are extremely difficult.
Well, that's right. But putting that issue aside, you know, everybody's going to have a proposal for what will make the system work. My experience is that every proposal then has downsides that no one has thought about in terms of, you know, results. And there, you're still relying on both a judge and a jury's supposed fair and impartial, which doesn't exist, mm-hmm. Determination. So a check and balance, even in the system, is a good idea. But you're still dealing with the fact that people bring baggage to the case. By the way, that last caller talked a lot about the O.J. case, which I write a lot about in the book, and that was an instance where perhaps we may see less involvement of televisions in the camera room just because of the circus that turned out to be.
Just have a few seconds left. There's a call from Fred in Greensville, North Carolina. I'm just going to put the nugget of his idea to you. He suggests professional jurors, not regular people.
Well, you know, that's like saying, gee, we have a technical case about engineering. Let's get a jury full of engineers. The problem is then you have the juror experts who then think, hey, I know this better than anybody. You still have the same bias problem. The whole idea is that a group of people plucked randomly from the community, from their daily jobs, can be taught the complexities of whatever the case is and given the opportunity to discuss it and come up with a proper, at least an upholdable verdict.
Paul Lisnick, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Paul Lisnick is a jury consultant. He's the author of The Hidden Jury. He was with us from our bureau in Chicago. When we come back, we'll speak with Ralph Eubanks about growing up in segregated Mississippi and how he explains his warm memories of his youth of the Jim Crow South to his own children. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.